are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 12th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, oh, I think this is a surprise for everybody. Guy Lawson will be joining us. Writer, author, mimer. Also on the program today, White House not in chaos and panic and not watching TV. Meanwhile, a massive iceberg breaks away in Antarctica. Hopefully, it will be crashing into all of us soon. Mitch McConnell to release Repeal and Replace 2.0 tomorrow. And Seattle's answer to money is speech. Meanwhile, the ACLU files suit against Trump's voter disenfranchisement task force. And today is July 12th, Save Net Neutrality Day. Trump considering an all-mercenary army in Afghanistan because why wouldn't he? And al-Baghdadi is dead. Will it make a difference to ISIS? All that and more.
Big league win for us.
On today's program. Sort of a coincidence, isn't it? Al-Baghdadi dead. And maybe Barack Obama looking for a new job. I mean, it's just a coincidence.
Or it could be that my Iranian comrades are moving forward. Shia. Death to Sunnis.
Who knows? That's very possible.
Shia's best. Death to Sunnis.
I didn't tell you that Guy Lawson was going to be on the program. Did I tell you that, Michael? No.
Yeah, you did.
Oh, I did.
Or okay, somebody said Matt told me.
Oh, okay, good. Yes, I wasn't sure if I had
mentioned
that. It's
on the post.
I just want to, whenever there's something like this, and it's happened one or two times before, and I have had, and I should also say I am in a remote location today, so I will be absent from the video feed because I don't get that level of connectivity here. But every time there is something like this that happens, and it's happened maybe two or three times over the past 5 or 6 years, I wonder whether or not we're doing the right thing by doing a show. Because today is Save Net Neutrality Day. And a lot of sites that support this are going dark. You know, and you go and you could get a loading message. And of course, this program, when we started 5 or 6 years ago, 7 years ago, this iteration of the program, there was in the back of my mind, well, this is going to go on to terrestrial radio. And for a while, we did have some replays on some low power FM stations. But for the most part, and we may still, actually, to be honest with you. But for the most part, this is an internet product. And technology has changed such that we can do that on a regular basis. But today is the internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality. You can go to battleforthenet.com/July12th. And the way I justify doing the show instead of having the show go dark is that, well, I can tell people about it. But of course, if you showed up today and there was no podcast and there was no live radio show, then you would probably go to battleforthenet.com/July12 the number 12, to see how you can send a message to the FCC and your senators and whatnot. Look, the bottom line is that elections have consequences. And despite the fact, and maybe those consequences are revolution, but before the revolution gets here, what's definitively here is a rollback on a lot of the things that are good and a roll forward on a lot of things that are bad. So we've been down this road before. We've fought for net neutrality. You got to do it again. So go again, battleforthenet.com/July12. We'll put that on the site. I am, like I say, not on video, which allows me to just sit here in MeUndies. And that is not, I'm not being vernacular.
Hello, Guy.
No, he's not here, sadly. I'm just going to be on the phone. And why MeUndies? Well, because MeUndies are the most comfortable underwear you'll wear, period, ever. Summer's the perfect time to upgrade your underwear drawer because everyone is thinking about looking good, feeling good. MeUndies are the ultimate feel-good undies. Every pair of MeUndies is sustainably sourced and made from Micromodal. Take it away, Matt.
I've been on Micromodal since 2011. Big fan.
Big fan.
I just have Matt saying modal lodged in my head.
Hold on one second. I got Guy calling me. All right. So modal, and you've been on it for years, like you say. This month's patterns were designed by the legendary 80s clothing brand, Cross Colors. Have you heard of that? That Cross Colors?
I haven't, but I do have dinosaur MeUndies on right now.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
I just go with the straight, solid colors. I'm boring that way. But this month's patterns, like I say, were designed by the legendary 80s clothing brand Cross Colors with names that live up to their bold design and bright colors. So, I mean, if you're increased duh piece, ya dig, and the OG, these are like built for Michael. You've got to get them for yourself. And right now you'll save 20% because you are the OG, right?
Of course.
Aren't you, Michael?
Of course.
Did you sign up for that?
Yeah, indeed.
Right now, you'll save 20% off your first pair and receive free shipping only at MeUndies.com/majority. Wow. 20% off your first pair. Receive free shipping. That's pretty good. There's a reason why MeUndies has sold over 5 million pairs to date. Wow. Get 20% off your first pair plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/majority. That's MeUndies. MeUndies.com/majority. MeUndies.com/majority. And ladies and gentlemen, even though I'm not on video today, I was on Hayes last night. Up in, Monday night.
Did you see the great camera freeze that someone isolated of you at the end of the show?
Yes.
Oh, that was brilliant.
It was actually pretty cool. It was up in Albany, and I am up in those environs. And, the guys up there have this little office, and they were from Burlington. So they used to just do Bernie's hits all the time. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it was fun. But I, Monday, I don't know, at about 5:30, what did I do? I shaved. Yes. I'm doing it less and less, so it becomes a big deal. But when I shave, you know this, I shave with Harry's. Because for decades, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. I'm not going to say who, but I think we all know. I'm not going to say the name Victor Kiam. I associate that with the Patriots. But I'm like talking like Trump. So Jeff and Andy, two ordinary
many
guys.
Many people know this.
Who were fed up with getting ripped off. Ripped off, huh?
Ripped off.
Ripped off. It's bad.
They said
ripped
it.
Ripped off is bad. Ripped off is bad.
Ripped off
is Started to Harry's good. To fix shaving. Harry knew there was only one way to ensure quality. And there is. There is only one way.
It's tough stuff.
So they bought their own blade factory. Just $2 a blade compared to the four or more you'll pay at the drugstore. Drugstore is bad. Harry's is so confident, You'll love their blades. They're giving you a trial set for free. Free. That's amazing. Is that right? Just cover shipping. Your free trial set includes, I've had a number of people email me, well, not me directly, but the show, saying they love it. A weighted ergonomic razor handle. 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. That's a $13 value for you to try. And is it free? Oh, just covering the shipping, which I don't know, a couple bucks, $3? Stop messing around. Get shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer, a $13 value for free. Just cover the shipping to get your free trial set, including a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, shave gel. Go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. All right, let's play this one clip before we get to Gee, who forgot that I told him 1220. This is one of those clips where you're like, I don't know who to root for in this argument or who is expressing anything that I would particularly agree with. So I'm just going to root for the bus that goes out of control down Sixth Avenue and just happens to like hit a studio on. Here is Tucker Carlson from Fox. He's still on Fox, right? And I think retired.
Isn't he in like Hannity's old spot?
O'Reilly's.
O'Reilly's old O'Reilly? Spot. Yeah. He's,
oh, yeah. He's I just wondered if they had gone through, I don't know, if they had promoted Jesse Waters again. And he's with retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, who is the Fox, what is his title? Fox News Security.
He's a general or something like that.
General. This is Tucker Carlson. I mean, look, I don't think that I laughed when Mitt Romney said Russia was our greatest rival. And I think it's still a funny proposition that Russia is our greatest enemy to me. I mean, not funny, ha ha, but peculiar. But the bottom line is that I don't care if, you know, France did this, but we'll talk more about the substance of this. It's just funny to watch how the right wing is trying to deal with this stuff. Let's play.
Vouching for Putin's character, which he seems like a shady guy, a strong man for sure, wouldn't want to live there.
He's a killer.
Hard to see why he's a threat to us. And how many wars can we fight at once? How many people can we be in opposition to at once? Why not just accept that people who are bad people share our interests and side with them?
He sounds like Charles Lindbergh in 1938 saying, Hitler hasn't attacked us.
I beg your pardon? Slow down. Hey, slow down, Colonel. I'm not in any way. You cannot compare me to someone who would make apologies for Hitler. And I don't think Putin is comparable to Hitler.
I think Putin is. Look,
I think it's
Putin,
a grotesque overstatement.
I think
it's insane.
Putin, fine. You can think it's insane all you want.
You just compared me to a Nazi apologist because I asked a simple question, contravene American interests in a common cause with a group that's trying to kill ISIS?
Invaded his neighbors, broken the long peace in Europe. He assassinates dissidents and journalists. He bombs women and children on purpose in Syria. He is as bad as Hitler. And I'm sorry, if you don't like the Charles Lindbergh thing, I will retract that. But let's just say you sound like someone in the 1938 saying, what's Hitler done to us? Putin is the equivalent of Hitler.
I would hate to go back and read your columns assuring America that taking out Saddam Hussein will make the region calmer, more peaceful, and America safer, when in fact it has done exactly the opposite, and it has empowered Russia and Iran, the two countries you say you fear most. Let's just be totally honest here. Yeah. We don't always know the outcomes.
Right.
They're not entirely predictable. And so maybe we should lower the moral tone a little bit.
Okay,
rather than calling people accommodationists and say we're not exactly sure what's going to happen. We can only make good decisions day by day.
You made your career being an American conservative patriot. And now you're suddenly cheering for Vladimir Putin?
I'm not in any sense cheering for Vladimir Putin.
Well, you said
it's not cheering for America as always. Our interests ought to come first. And to the extent that making temporary alliances with other countries serve our interests, I'm in favor of that. Making sweeping moral claims, grotesque ones, comparing people to Hitler, advances the ball not one inch.
Vladimir Putin blinds us to reality. He hates America. He wants to hurt us. And I'm sorry. All this, suddenly Vladimir Putin's a good guy. Russia's okay. No, it's not. Russia is evil.
So what's your
Russia
moral test? So some.
Okay.
Wow.
How great is that?
Wow. That's pretty good.
That's like Ralph Peters' job at Fox News is to do that stuff.
Well, I got to say, yes, I love the fact that Tucker Carlson was willing to call out his Iraq war stuff. Now, of course, Tucker Carlson also initially supported the Iraq war. But I don't think Tucker Carlson is Charles Lindbergh. Maybe he's like Bill Lindbergh, just some other guy. Like, we had to go to that.
Charles Lindbergh's brother that was just kind of a dick?
No, not even related. Just coincidence. Just the same last name.
I mean, I'm not, Tucker Carlson's horrible, but I mean, to go primetime on Fox, in his case, I mean, he's carrying water for Trump, but he's also, he's trying to cool down things in terms of Iran and Russia on primetime on Fox News. And he's also given Mark Blythe a platform. I mean, I would say modest improvement over Bill O'Reilly. He's also a lot more entertaining.
Yes, I would say that's the case. Although there is, of course, the deficiency, the lack of the D-man makes it, it's just not the same show.
But I don't know if Tucker could pretend the D-man was funny in the same way.
Yes, that would take more effort. And, of course, you'd have to bring up what the D-man said about Iraq as well.
The D-man.
Fascinating. I mean, what's interesting about this is watching how, I mean, more than anything else, sort of some of the propagandist outlets having to twist themselves into knots. That is the interesting thing about this to a certain extent. And of course, I guess there's some of that on the, you know, center left as well, but not nearly the way it is at Fox. That, to me, I'm enjoying quite a bit. All right, we're going to go grab Guy in a second. Just a reminder, folks, Michael Brooks is starting his own show and oddly called it The Michael Brooks Show.
Yeah, very inventive.
Did you do Michael underscore Brooks?
The underscore Michael Brooks show.
The underscore Michael Brooks. You know what I love is when the Sam Harris trolls go on tirades and this poor at Michael Brooks gets like, you have distorted.
Well, I also don't appreciate the fact that I get caught up in those things and I get like, oh no, now I got to go look at that video. But Michael is looking to get a 1,000 Patreon signer uppers. And he's already at 130. So head over there and sign up. Michael briefly mentioned the show yesterday. It is, it will be two shows a week, but you only get one.
Three, actually, for members.
Oh, three for members.
It's going to be three for members. I'll explain it to you. But one public, and then there's two different short member shows.
Okay, so two different short member shows. But nevertheless, the members get all the good stuff and all the bad stuff goes on the free show.
All
right?
The bad stuff goes on the free show. There's also a private Slack
He's learned
group
from
for
the
members
master.
As well. Yes.
A private Slack. Oh, my
private
God.
Private Slack group, yes, for a longer form conversation with me and other people who are going to be.
And Michael will never turn it off.
Never.
All right, we're going to take
your
a quick
beck
break.
And call. Thank so you, everybody, to, so much who signed
what,
up.
What's the URL, Michael?
It's Patreon. It's www.
Good
yes.
job. Good job.
You have it, Matt?
Patreon.com/TMBS, The Michael Brooks Show.
Oh, TMBS, yeah. The Michael Brooks Show. You had one job. All right,
no,
folks.
No, and it's also linked to on majority.fm. With a video explaining the show more fully. So thanks, everybody who's done it so far. Thanks, Sam.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Guy Lawson. So I wait my turn, I'm a modern man. And the people behind me, they can't understand. Makes me feel like Okay, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. The New York Times bestselling author of Arms and the Dudes. Also, the bestselling, was it Octopus a bestselling?
Yep.
Oh, my God. How many?
You know, it depends how you define it. I don't lay a big claim to that stuff.
All right. Well,
people might know it as War Dogs, the movie, with Arms and the Dudes. But anyway.
Okay. Well, let's put it this way, folks. The bestselling author. And who are you writing for now? New York Times Magazine?
Yeah.
Okay.
New York Times Magazine. Longtime Rolling Stones.
So many Rolling other Stone places. Guy Lawson. And, of course, spending his time making sure that all his old friends back in Canada keep his apartment warm for him, right? I mean, this is the thing that I really sort of have come to resent about you, is that the ability you have to just cross the border.
I'm a triple threat. I can go to Australia, too. I'm a citizen there, too.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. When is that going to happen, or do you not announce that publicly?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was just on the phone with my best friend. I went to university in Australia, and my best, you know, you make these great friends at college years, as you know, you've got your pals like Benjamin. And he's gone on to this crazy successful business career. He's the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company. But he's still the same dude to me, right? You know, we're still 18-year-olds together. So I was asking him what he thinks of the United States right now. And it was fascinating because the country kind of just looks foolish internationally. I don't know if you've had anyone on talking about that, but this is not a guy that's prone to, you know, political extremism or even really political punditry, but he just kind of, it just all looks so polarized and dysfunctional, I guess is what you'd expect.
Well,
plastic.
I think
plastic was the use. He used the word plastic. It looks plastic.
You know, that's interesting because, I mean, I think from the perspective of people here, I think there's this sense of like, oh, well, it's temporary. We'll recover from this. But I think from people outside of this country, they see the problem not as Trump. They see Trump as indicative of some type of greater problem in this country.
And I think that's right. True. And he talked about how the media is so polarized. And, you know, he feels for me as a journalist, he says, you know, you should just be careful. Like, don't contribute to that. And I really feel like the age old friend wisdom of that. You know, I made the point to him that the polarization that doesn't move equally in both directions, say liberal or conservative, that the kind of the Fox contingent is much more sort of insulated and polarized and angry than the kind of the liberal part of the country, quadrant, if you want to call it. And the people in the middle are kind of just befuddled and just trying to keep up with events. But, you know, that's like a thin argument to someone looking at us from overseas.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't, you know, sure, okay, yeah, but it's really polarized. Which puts me in mind of Hannity last night, you know, had Donald Trump Jr. on and an exclusive, and I watched it, and you know, you have a clip of the, no doubt, of Donald Trump talking, Donald Trump Jr., but the show began with like this 10-minute rant about the liberal media being forced to watch the show and all the things that the liberal media should learn and know. And he took it like this moment to kind of lecture or hector the quote unquote liberal media as if number one, they were captive to him, and as if number two, that this was going to succeed. It was so clearly not aimed at the liberal media. It was aimed at his audience thinking that this is how to talk to the liberal media. So it was like not even meta. It was just like performance art in a way. And it just made me feel like kind of sad. It was just kind of sad. Like, why do we talk to each other like that? Why do people, you know, do you do that in your regular life? You know,
do you
shout at people? I know you do to your daughter, but that's normal parenting. But do you function that way? You know, you disagree with people about things. Do you shout at them and treat them like they're idiots? It just seems to be, I don't see so much as polarization as just anger. I had the experience of being involved in a business with someone who was a big Trump supporter and has since left. My wife and I have a business together. And it was just so much, you know, schadenfreude. Like, he wanted me to suffer. He positively took pleasure in the idea that I was unhappy.
Well, then,
and I just don't know what good can come of that.
The whole Trump phenomena, it seems to me, is, and I would say it's not just the Trump phenomena. It's largely the right over the years has become one of aggrievement. And the only thing that assuages their aggrievement is the idea that others feel grief. I mean, you know, I don't want to get too sort of, ham-fisted about it, but, you know, for a long time, I mean, look, the number one policy, I think, prescription for the right is liberals will hate it, therefore will like it. I mean, that's the way they put it. I mean, that's what going after Obamacare is all about, because it's called Obamacare. That's what,
I saw this interview with this guy in the newspaper, you know, probably the liberal New York Times. I don't know. But they basically were asking him. He's a 55-year-old guy in West Virginia who's going to lose his health insurance under this reform. And he's got multiple maladies, you know, things, chronic things, diabetes and obesity and all the sort of the suite of things that you get if you don't eat well and you're in your 50s, you know, like just the problems of life. And they said, well, you're going to, you know, your insurance premium is going to go to $2,000 a month, which is more than you can possibly pay. And he said, well, I guess you got to start somewhere. And I guess we should get going with that now. It's just so like contrary to his own interests, to even life and death, that it just makes you wonder about the rational political discourse. My friend in Australia has talked about how it's a centrist country. There's broad agreement about the role of government, that, you know, that more or less it should try to do good in people's lives, and more or less it should try to, you know, not discriminate, and more or less it should try to, you know, enter into good international trade pacts that, you know, see the future and support our basic industry. Just things that, you know, if you could just sit and rationally discuss things, you could probably get done in America. But it just seems like the thing is so broken. And from a journalistic point of view, how do you cover that? You know, I mean, it's a quandary, because, you know, it just becomes like polling questions. Instead of leading discussions, you're following it. And instead of, you know, being ahead of stories, you're always behind them. And that's been my sensation with the Trump administration. You know, you asked me to come on just to give you my take. You know, so I write for the New York Times Magazine, and I've spent basically the time since the election, so what's that, like 7-8 months? Trying to figure out long-form, like feature article, not newspaper article, feature articles to cover the Trump administration in a meaningful way. Not adversarially, but not fawning either, but just to try to find stories that will, you know, describe the history of, you know, Donald Trump and the policies that he's pursuing and the people that are surrounding him. And it's been so frantic and nonstop, and my friend in Australia calls it monotonous. In his view, people are just tuning it out. But in the American sense, just so, like, every news cycle is a new thing that it's hard. It's proving impossible to figure out what will be relevant in 3 or 4 months that it takes to report, write, edit, and print a feature article. It's just, that's why you're not getting substantial coverage of the Trump era in the New Yorker and the New York Times Magazine and Atlantic and places like that. You're getting kind of blog posts about them.
Right.
You know, like the daily coverage. You'll get 500 words from an editor, or you'll get, you know, a little take or a scoop. But those really meaty, understanding of, say, environmental policy under Trump, it's just because it's just so unfocused.
Environmental policy is probably one of the few areas.
That's probably one. Yeah, you could do it. That's right.
You could actually do it, because Scott Pruitt is
succeeding.
Greg Pruitt. He's succeeding because, I mean, he was really the only one who was a pro at completely dismantling the EPA. I mean, that is probably the one area where there's a certain amount of competence.
That was a bad example. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have.
But it's the perfect example that proves the rule. You couldn't do that. I mean, you could maybe do that with Betsy DeVos to a certain extent, but it really, again, is all it is destruction in many respects. And certainly there's no I don't think there's a core set of beliefs that you could distill as being part of the Trump administration. I think the reason why, and right now it just seems like there's a huge, huge amount of sort of like it's a Game of Thrones in the White House. But I think part of that is also from a policy standpoint, none of them, you know, maybe Bannon has a vision, you know, a dark one, but the rest
I think Mnuchin has a vision, you know, get rid of Medicare. All these things that they wanted to do, the Republicans wanted to do, they're doing. They're just doing it in this sort of inverse, stealthy, attempted to be stealthy way, like it's Obamacare repeal rather than Medicare repeal.
Right.
But you know, on the sort of the larger narrative, it's like if I was out reporting a piece, like for example, I've been reading biographies, and it's the Trump has got a bunch of books out there about him, and by him, that are fascinating, and you know, it's a cosmic, I don't know what, it's like this sort of tectonic moment that the same day that Donald Trump took office, the journalist who covered him more than anybody and better than anybody, a guy named Wayne Barrett,
right,
died.
Yeah, we had Wayne on just before he passed, actually.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy,
yep.
and for a bunch of reasons. One of them is that he churned out this whole generations of journalists who he trained to research and report. And there's, and maybe some of them are listening, or people know people that work with Wayne Barrett. But he wrote a book on Trump that is just, I would really highly recommend, because, you know, Trump hated him, and so, you know, you could say I'm, you know, endorsing a person that Trump hated, and therefore I'm in the liberal media. But Barrett was a thorough and extremely experienced reporter. And what comes across if you read his book on Donald Trump is that this kind of frantic lurching from moment to moment and having multiple things go in multiple directions at the same moment that we're experiencing now, that's his life.
Right.
It's always been like this. You know, I keep thinking about this, you know, in 1988, Donald Trump, 88, 89, 90, he had the kind of the great undoing. The real estate market in New York fell apart. He owned these multiple casinos in Atlantic City. He was having an affair on his wife with Marla Maples.
Tax code was changed in 86 that severely undercut a lot of his tax shenanigans.
Yeah, and his son, Donald Trump Jr., wasn't talking to him because he was cheating on his mom. He just had like nine things in his life. And you know, there's a helicopter crash and he lost his executive team. And he blamed, and then he took the opportunity, according to one of his executives, to blame these dead people for all his woes. That's another book that got written by one of his executives. But it was just, it's so frantic.
I prefer people that don't
that
die.
When you sort of delve into it and you understand that this is how he lives, I mean, it just, you know, I've been saying for some time now that it must be really not a happy time for him.
I mean, I think the guy's not a happy person.
Yeah.
Right? And I think he's so detached.
So I guess I want to be a little happy, but I'm still trying to unscrew this, uncork this, you know, the idea of how do you cover like large frame historical events in a meaningful way and know what's going to work in 3 to 6 months? You know, 3 months ago, if I told you 3 months ago that Donald Trump Jr. was emailing back and forth about the Russian government giving them help, you know, I don't know what I would say. I mean, I guess I probably wouldn't have been surprised, but it's just like every day is a new like thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I think, you know, it is. I think, you know, I'm not. This is a broader societal thing too, right? But he's like showing the weakness of I guess the way that society has moved in terms of coverage and of understanding. I mean, part of it is like there's no broad con. There's no like we have failed significantly in like some type of civil education in this country in terms of like, you know, how civil society is supposed to work. And so
yeah.
There's a lot of things that I think people don't appreciate that are happening, that are going, that are going to have long-term impact, right? I mean, like, I think really the long-term story of Donald Trump is not necessarily about Trump, but more about, sort of broadly speaking, what happens with autocracies and what are the different flavors, right? I mean, because...
Yeah, I keep thinking about the rule of law, and, you know, it's sort of, it's a nation of laws,
right?
And it's a nation of norms. And, in, you know, the balance that the founding fathers wanted was much more heavily leaning on the laws. But when you get down to this kind of level where the law could be unseating a president who perhaps was elected by breaking the law, then you really have like a crisis, like and not just a constitutional crisis, but an existential crisis. And, you know, history shows that those get answered, that kind of vacuum, that kind of lack of coherence, you know, can lead to the rise. And I'm not saying Donald Trump is this, of authoritarians. You know, it's like you said earlier, people think this is just like a one-off. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like it's, you know, this is why you and I have young children. I'm concerned for their well-being, because this is this the new way of doing things that, you know, in banana republics, you jail your opponents.
Yeah,
or I mean, you kill them.
We're not there yet, obviously. But I mean, when you see things like the ethics chief, right, resigning, like it seems to me that that's a position that's not going to get filled under the Trump administration.
Right.
And that the next president who comes in is very unlikely to say, hey, all those restrictions that we used to have, I want those for me and my administration.
Yeah.
I want to limit our ability to do things, because even though nobody's really paying attention to that. Now, there's going to be talk about it when Joe Scarborough throws his hat in the ring now that he's independent with Michael Bloomberg's money. And his running mate, Chris Christie's former self, when they got,
Chris Christie,
but when they run, they're going to be like, we're going to restore dignity and, you know, whatever. But once they get into office, they're not going to. Well, we said dignity. We didn't say ethics necessarily. I mean, we're going to be ethical, but we just don't need that extra apparatus. That is just an example, it seems to me, of what's going to happen in the future. All of these norms, all of these sort of like rules that weren't quite laws, even some of the laws and, you know, like the emoluments thing, like, you know, that never came up before because most presidents, regardless of who they were, said, oh, I have to respect the office. And now that idea is, you know, completely out the window. Jimmy Carter sold his peanut farm, for God's sakes. And
yeah.
You can
get yourself, you know, like it's sort of like, you know, you can be like Pollyanna about it or you can be Cassandra about it. But what's happening, you know, in front of our eyes is definitely a change in the basic understandings about what it means to be like a citizen. We've had so lots of these soldiers to be president, right? People who would literally sacrifice their lives, or, you know, people who've been in career politicians. It's just, I don't know, it feels like kind of anybody, Oprah, you know, Joe Scarborough, who's next?
I mean Zuckerberg. I mean, and the thing is that I mean, you know, let's say it was Zuckerberg, for instance, you know, the idea of him divesting from Facebook, right? I mean, like, okay, you know, he's just gonna say like, well, the precedent's been set. I can assure you, I'm going to be much better than Donald Trump in just about every area. It's just I'm going to keep Facebook at arm's length or whatever. I mean, that seems to me to be a little bit problematic. I mean, we've opened up the and I just don't know that you can dial this stuff back. And
well, you know, maybe we can do a little tiny, you know, simply recognizing that we have a responsibility to do that can be a first step, right? So to practice what you preach, to actually, you know, to have the introspection to say, well, why is it that, for example, Trump, you know, certain amount of Trump supporters so hate, you know, the liberal media, meaning you and me, Sam, and the college educated, meaning you and me, Sam, you know, and North Northeasterners, New Yorkers, meaning you and me. So, you know, a little introspection there. Like, what are we sort of driving past? What are we ignoring? And how can we talk about it in a more civil way instead of just sort of remarking upon as if it's a phenomenon that moves in one direction only? You know, I don't know. I'm just talking to my friend in Australia. It was kind of like, it was sobering because he's, you know, he comes to America all the time on business, and he's, you know, he cares about it. His son wants to come here and go to college. And he says that people, Australians, for example, and I think this is right, can make the distinction between the government or the current administration and society. But what we're talking about is those things coming together, or that this is a reflection of something bigger in society. And, you know, I'm not like trying to be like a elected high school president by talking about, let's do it, you know, school spirit, you know, jolly, jolly gosh, let's go be nice to everybody. But at the same time, you know, it matters. You know, the fact that my friend is concerned that I'm going on your show and that he wants me to try to be like moderate, it's just like, well, yeah, maybe I really should, you know, instead of going off.
Well, I don't think that's going to help because, frankly, with all due respect to your friend, that's how we got here.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, isn't it? Know, rolling over.
I mean, there was, and look, and here's the thing is that, I mean, I suppose, listen, civility is one thing, but the bottom line is that in this country anyways, what if you're a moderate, it really just means you're hiding your ideology. You don't recognize that you have an ideology because you think that your values are so are normative. Like, you don't understand, you know, like the idea of like, well, of course we're not going to provide healthcare for everybody. We can't do that. That's a moderate right. position. Well, it's not. I mean,
well, it's funny you bring that up because that's a story that I pitched to the New York Times. I think I'm going to hear from them in the next day or two. Probably won't want it, but I wanted to do a story of the history of how Canada got universal medical care. And what's fascinating about that is I know the man who did it. And his name was Tommy Douglas. He's actually Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather.
He leveraged Sutherland's... he leveraged his son's Hollywood career. I'm joking.
Well, No. That's... You know, Tommy Douglas is... daughter married Donald Sutherland.
Oh, okay. All right.
But Tommy Douglas is 100 times bigger deal in Canada than Donald Sutherland ever could be. He's, you know, if you ask Canadians, who's the most beloved Canadian in history, it's Tommy Douglas every time, over Pierre Trudeau or anyone else. And what Tommy Douglas does was what happened in Canada and what can happen in this country is he ran a province called Saskatchewan where I lived, and my father worked for him, and I knew Tommy Douglas. Just a tiny bit. I was a little kid. But he basically compelled everybody, he compelled the hospitals and the doctors to and created a law that provided medical care for free to everyone in Saskatchewan, everybody who lived in Saskatchewan. I don't think you even have to be a citizen, in 1962. And the doctors went on strike. And what happened was is that the thing, you know, when implemented, when everybody had health care for free, and it was paid for through taxes, it wasn't like some magic mystery thing, you know, it was paid for, it was funded, because this guy was a Baptist minister, he was a skinflint, you know, he wasn't a spendthrift. But there was a huge struggle and a huge fight, and the fight was led by the American Medical Association, because they recognized that if this system works in one place and really works well, that's a threat to everywhere.
Right.
And that's what happened in Canada. It worked in Saskatchewan so blindingly well that by four years later, it was implemented nationally. And it's been the most popular thing in Canada ever since. If you ask Canadians in a poll, what's the number one thing about being Canadian? It's their healthcare system. What are they most proud of? Healthcare. What do you most care about? Healthcare. You know, and outcomes for healthcare are so much better there than here, and costs are so much lower. So, you know, that's an example where, you know, he stood up to the fight. He stood up to the powers. So maybe there's a state in this country that can do that and show that it works. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, could really be a deal changer.
We've seen two, I guess, nascent attempts, you could say, in New York and California over the past couple of months run into both sort of like procedural and political roadblocks.
Right, really, universality? I mean, you know, I mean, like the idea that single payer and universality have been attempted?
Yeah, well, California and New York were winding bills through their various bodies. In California, it ran up against, it remains to be seen how serious that effort is. People sound like it's serious. They just haven't necessarily done all the work that is going to be necessary to make it serious. And there are like procedural and sort of statutory limits to what budgetary money can do in California. And in New York, you have the IDC. But like a place like Vermont.
You know,
which was slated to attempt it, you know, 4 or 5 years ago and abandoned it because they didn't have the political capital to sell the idea of these raised taxes to people. I mean, you know, part of the problem is that, broadly speaking, you know, I think people like the idea when you ask them on polling questions, but
yeah,
the problem
even
is,
Donald Trump said he liked it during the election.
Yes, but the problem is that the American public needs to have a deeper understanding of like how just a deeper understanding of how government can actually be effective and how
yeah.
you pay government 75 cents and you'll get you'll save yourself a buck when it comes to healthcare. And, you know, for those people out there who thinks that's magic, you just need to look at Medicare, compare it to private insurance, and costs are lower
exactly.
for Medicare and administrative costs are lower, and there's no profit margin. I mean,
that's the profit margin is the key. And
well,
the other
cost
key,
containment,
the, other key.
The cost containment on the on
right.
the doctor side, because that's why the doctors go on strike, is because they're not going to get paid as much. Now,
that's exactly it. That's exactly it. It's exactly it. It's not only on doctors, of course, and it's
right,
not.
But I say broadly,
it's not
speaking,
simple thing,
hospitals
but it's the pharmaceutical
drug,
companies.
Pharmaceutical, yes.
It's all that sort of like the incentives to overprescribe drugs, the kind of like the golf trips and all that kind of thing. And, you know, and the American system, I wrote about the oxycodone epidemic for Rolling Stone, I guess it was 18 months ago. And what people don't understand about this epidemic that's plaguing the country, all these incredible numbers of overdoses and addiction and the families that are being destroyed, that is a for-profit business. That is Coca-Cola. You know, there are companies around this country. One just got fined $35 million yesterday in New York State, or maybe it was Connecticut. But these are for-profit companies that want to proliferate their product as much as they can. And so you have these addictive pain pills that are put into the marketplace under prescriptions, and people find a way to get these prescriptions and get themselves addicted to it, and then they find they can't afford it. And then there's the Mexicans cartel selling heroin for $5 a baggie, and next thing you know, you're dead, or you're overdosed, or your son or your daughter's in rehab with a hopeless addiction. So, you know, removing the for-profit element to these kinds of industries, to the industry of life and death, you know, it has lots of different implications. This isn't to say that Canada doesn't have opioid problems. It does. It has a lot of it, but not. I don't think it's nearly on the scale, and it certainly isn't for the same for-profit reasons, the same kind of banality behind these things. You know, I don't know. It's kind of anyway. I pitched that story. I'd love to tell that story to Americans because they could see that these things don't. That these kind of consensuses don't emerge from, you know, everyone holding hands. And to return to your original idea about, like, you know, rolling over, being moderate, you know, the consensus can come by, you know, forging on and taking up a fight.
Yeah. And
winning and then showing your way is better.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I mean, that's why I think people are so heavily invested in the idea of New York or California being those
yeah.
states. And, you know, you have a guy like Andrew Cuomo in New York State who, in many respects, is the, I don't know, the midwife for the IDC, if you ask me, which is the Democrats who, if they voted with the Democratic Party or caucus with the Democrats in the New York Senate, would provide Democrats with the majority, but they caucus with Republicans. With Andrew Cuomo's sort of tacit wink, I guess.
Yeah.
And then in California, you have like a dual problem of sort of referendum, dictating a lot of what happens in terms of policy. And then it allows, more conservative or moderate Democrats to hide behind that. And so it's a problem. But all right, let me ask you this before we go, because obviously in the past 3 or 4 days, there have been revelations about Trump Jr. That I think are of a different ilk than what we have heard before, right? For the first time, I mean, for a long time, you could say, okay, it's not inconceivable to me that all of this Russia contacts could be a function of like, well, we wanted to deal with policy. We just knew it wasn't going to be politically appetizing to people. And so we kept it a secret. And that's why we didn't reveal it to things. Or even I would go as far as saying, like, it could be that Jared Kushner was trying to do back channels to China and to a couple other countries because he knows his father-in-law is insane. And he wants the ability to just sort of say, like, hey, you know that thing when Dad said today in that meeting that we would give you all our nukes, you know, for a deal for his ties? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can't do that. So I just want you to know. But the meeting with Eric Jr., Donald Jr., and the emails to Kushner and Manafort sort of suggest that, at the very least, they were into this. And I have to say, there was a story today that I don't know why it didn't occur to me, but there was a story today, I think it was, or yesterday. Mueller is looking into Jared Kushner's online operation. And the idea that, and this is the first time where I saw, where something like this made sense to me as to why there should, you know, why either party would need a relationship with each other, which is Kushner had access to all the voter file data stuff. And the theory was, like, we can micro-target these people through Facebook and particularly Facebook.
Yeah.
But we don't have the army for it. Well, the Russians do. I mean, and the idea that information passed back and forth was the first time I was like, yeah, actually that, I don't know if that happened, but that would make some sense. The rest of it, not so much, but that would make some sense to me. What, where are you on this, and how much of this is just P tape stuff?
You know, it feels like the beginning of something, not the middle or end of it. I guess a question that I have on this is, do the Democrats do this kind of stuff? I mean, you know, is this a one way street? Like, was Hillary Clinton's campaign trying to, you know, deliberately misinform and manipulate and do any, really what appears to be anything to win?
I think they do some of it. I mean, I think, like, obviously, like, the original dossier, right, was supposedly from either, if not Bush, it was from Republicans. It was assembled during the Republican primary. And then their Oppo research people took it over. The Oppo research people do this kind of stuff. But I know, like, there were times, I think, when, you know, people have cited this Al Gore was approached by foreign governments. I mean, I think there's, like, lines that are drawn at least that high up, it seems to me. And I think, you know, Republicans, I think, are definitely much more, I think, willing, you know, because winning, you know, it's analogous to their perspective on government, right? Governing's not so important, but, you know, winning is.
You know, I a friend of mine invested in Russia and knows Russia very well, and I was hanging out with him the other week, and a friend of his is a banker for a Russian bank in New York. He's an American guy, but so I was just curious what his take is, and I didn't know his politics at all. But I knew that he deals, you know, he deals with Russians all the time. And I said, so what do you think the story is? This is before all this stuff had broken. This is not all this stuff. There was, the Russian thing was ongoing. It, you know, Trump was calling it fake news. President Trump's calling it fake news. And this whole witch hunt thing is going on. And he said to me, to my kind of astonishment, but I, you know, maybe I should actually think about it some more. He said, the real story is Hillary Clinton. I'm like, what on earth? She's not even president, dude. Like, you know, the losing, you don't investigate the losing party in an election typically, right? Like, you're kind of more interested in what the people in power are doing. But, you know, maybe that is an interesting question to think about, because if it is the norm between them both, then things are way more broken than I understood.
Right. Now, what did he mean by that, though, about Clinton?
Her Russian ties and kind of, you know, it just sounded kooky to me. Like, you know, the best defense is an offense. And it sounded, you know, like a rhetorical kind of a game rather than anything of substance. But he still wants to meet him. Maybe I'll go have lunch with him and just to hear him out. But I guess, you know, from a normative point of view, if politics is being conducted with that kind of degree of a lack of any kind of sense of decency, democracy, just like we'll do and say anything to win, then that is really not good for this country, I don't think. And I've been mystified by Jared Kushner, to be honest.
Your buddy's response is not terribly out of the blue. I mean, because that is specifically what the Russian attorney, as she's come to have been known now, offered, according to Donald Trump, was not the email list or this and that, was her relationship with Russians.
Yeah.
So who knows? But
well, you know, I mean, I guess what you can take from that is that at the very least, meaning the Trump campaign, were, you know, trolling for anything they could get.
Well, and they were meeting with people that they knew were from a foreign government to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? I mean, and of course, we know stuff like this has gone down in the past, right? I think, like, you know, sending word to scuttle the Paris peace talks
Iran hostages.
Yes. I mean, and there you had a lot of people die in those scenarios. Yeah. And so this is just one that seems to be unfolding in real time and not necessarily with the same. I mean, the stakes are different. I don't want to, you know, get into apples and oranges, but people's lives have not been, or at least the numbers of lives, you know. But
what's remarkable to me about this, and this is just a fresh thought, so just take it for what it's worth. And but what's remarkable to me is in the parliamentary system, you have inherent to it an opposition party. You have a leader who stands up in parliament and in front of the press and coherently speaks truth or whatever, disagrees with or opposes what the government is doing in various situations or agrees with them. But there's nothing like that in this country. There's nobody to cohere around. There's just literally a vacuum.
And I would say there's no. I mean, theoretically, right? That should be Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, good luck with that.
But also, there's no sort of standing institution, right? Where it's you get up in Parliament and it's the time for the opposition to speak. That doesn't have the same resonance in this country. It is like dueling press conferences, essentially, and
not even dueling. It's not even really dueling. There's just
not
presidents. There's a president, and there's a bunch of chirping birds.
Right.
I mean, it's just, you know, I watched Tim Kaine last night. You know, started talking about this is maybe treason, and then you know you see what's his name, the bow tie guy, Tucker Carlson. You know. In his show, because I watched Fox last night. I urge your listeners to do that.
We played a clip of Tucker Carlson getting into it with his security guy about whether or not he was Lindbergh.
Yeah, I mean, he started out the show saying, now the Democrats are talking about lethal injection for Donald Trump Jr. because Tim Kaine used the word treason. Like, that's the kind of reductive rhetoric that they employed. Like, all of a sudden, it's like lethal injection time. But
right. Wouldn't you hang someone for treason?
Yeah, there you go.
Right.
So, but there's kind of like, it's maybe that's just like something that's inherent to this system with the executive branch the way it is. But it is amazing to me that there's no coherent voice against or trying to articulate in a reasonable, sensible, sustainable way an opposition agenda to the president? Nobody.
I mean, well, part of it, I think that it's difficult. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders is out there talking about it. You have other Democratic leaders that are out there talking about it. But part of it is what is the problem is that Donald Trump's agenda is so malleable. And I mean, in many respects, you see, you can see it on an issue basis, right? I mean, we have a sense of what the Democrats are saying against the health care repeal and replace. Taxes, tax cut for billionaires, cutting Medicaid. But even the press seems to think that that is a secondary import. And I don't know. It's hard to know, you know, what is driving the other. And but, of course, ratings, you're going to get a lot more ratings talking about the Trump administration than a health care reform. And believe me, I know, because we've been talking about, you know, I think we like every show seems to be split along those lines. Health care and the latest insanity from the Trumpistas. But
well, I hope that the ratings for the Majority Report are going up, too.
Well, you know, they've gone up. I mean, certainly we get a lot more people listening than we did year or two ago, and for probably not the best of reasons. Well, no, I mean, I imagine the best of reasons. You know what I mean?
Well, no, I think they value a voice of, you know, of
moderation.
Maybe that's what moderate. Well, opposition, a voice that comes from a place of independence and principle.
Well, Guy, that's very kind of you. Your Canadian is showing.
I'll do my Aussie. I can leave you with an Aussie, eh?
All right. Well, Guy Lawson, folks, I hope you're following Guy on Facebook at the very least at guylawson.author. Is that it? Guy?
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
And on Twitter, it's Guy Lawson, then the number 2. I don't know who Guy Lawson 1 is, but screw that guy.
Love you, Sam.
All right, Guy, thanks. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care, man.
Bye.
Ciao.
Bloop, bloop. Guy Lawson. Are you guys in New York still there, or have I been doing this to myself?
We're trying to be civil.
Oh, yes, I know. Yes. Well, that's what happens. Like, if you're Canadian, all it takes is one conversation with somebody. And then you're like, hey, maybe I shouldn't be so mean.
Why do you keep mocking our uniforms and mustaches? Oh, yeah, I never thought of it like that before. Maybe I ought to consider doing a piece on it.
He'll come back around.
No, Guy is amazing because I actually think Guy is maybe the most insightful, kind of astute, long-term guest in terms of like the pathologies of our country and how we do capitalism and our military industrial complex. And then on the other hand, he's like, then we ought to be more polite. I'm going to watch Fox.
Yes. That's what happens when you're Canadian. I really do think that's the problem with being Canadian, is that you just can't help but be nice. Well, we're not Canadian here, folks. You know why we have so many Canadians who listen to this show? Because it's like why Americans would listen to Howard Stern. they get to hear people talk politics and things that they like, but with just a little more attitude than, you know, would be appropriate in everyday life in Canada.
I like that. That's like a sort of questionable Obama impression. Is like the equivalent of like throwing salami at a stripper for Canadians.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's like our conversations about our sardonic conversations about healthcare is basically for them like going to Scores.
This is real edgy, eh? He called that Republican senator a jerk and noted that Ted Cruz is not exactly aesthetically pleasing. Whoa, these guys are out of control.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. If you have the means, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And you'll have access to our fun half every day. We put out so much content for you folks. So much. And if you don't even want that, still you can support the free half or the less fun half of the show, as we like to call it. Because we don't, our marketing department got, we had problems with our marketing department. Let's just put it that way. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And if you buy stuff from Amazon or Jet.com, you can do so through our links at MajorityReportKickback.com. We've got some sound coming up. We will talk a little more about we got the Senate health bill coming out, unveiled 2.0 tomorrow. Some interesting possible developments on the tax cuts for the wealthy. I have a feeling they'll do that. They'll do that later. But we'll talk about that. Also, the reaction from the right-wing media on the latest. The emails are pretty stunning.
Love it.
We'll get to that. And folks, as you know, it probably doesn't need to be said, but I guess you can't say it enough. We are teaching way too much about slavery in schools, according to Brian Fisher, the host of Focal Point. And all right, we've got a lot more to talk about. We will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920, if all goes well. And we will take your IMs in the fun half. We'll be right back for the fun half.
No, things are looking bad.